What is it? The thing that you don't like about me?
It was a word you used that provoked me. You called me arrogant.
To plunder, as it were, a God-given right, I'd call that arrogant, Daddy.
But that is exactly what I don't like about you. It's you that is arrogant.
That's what you came here to say. I'm not the one passing judgment, Daddy. You are.
You do not pass judgment because you sympathize with a deprived childhood. And a homicide really isn't necessarily a homicide, right? The only thing you can blame is circumstances. Rapists and murderers may be the victims, according to you, but I call them dogs. And if they're lapping up their own vomit, the only way to stop them is with a lash.
But dogs only obey their own nature, so why shouldn't we forgive them?
Dogs can be taught many useful things, but not if we forgive them every time they obey their own nature.
So I'm arrogant. I'm arrogant because I forgive people.
Oh my God. Can't you see how condescending you are when you say that? I mean, you have this preconceived notion that nobody can possibly attain the same high ethical standards as you, so you exonerate him. I cannot think of anything more arrogant than that. You, my child, my dear child, you forgive others with excuses that you would never in the world permit for yourself.
Why shouldn't I be merciful? Why?
No, you should. You should be merciful when there's time to be merciful, but you must maintain your own standards. You owe them that. You owe them that. The penalty you deserve for your transgression, they deserve for their transgressions.
They're human beings.
Does every human being need to be accountable for their actions? Of course they do. You don't even give them that chance. And that is extremely arrogant. I love you. I love you. I love you to death. But you are the most arrogant person I have ever met. And you call me arrogant.
Alright, are you back?
Alrighty.
Yeah, it's too bad Mark couldn't come. I like his perspective on this. I think he would be a... he's got the... I don't want to put ideas into his mouth or into his mind, but he's got sort of the evil demiurgic take on things, which
absolutely. He can see the worst possible scenario from a very intelligent and informed perspective. His paintbrush, is remarkable in that manner.
So I was looking forward to kind of taking a middle position between your kind of rosy point of view and then Mark's doom and gloom.
No, absolutely. Right. That was exactly the kind of balance I was hoping to get out of this conversation. But I think one of the drawbacks of having that kind of paintbrush is that, you know, it's your paintbrush you don't necessarily, like I said, I'm not going to speak for Mark, and I'll just say I miss his input tonight, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, what did...
So, yeah, I don't know if you remember before, we were talking about, you, at the very end of our conversation, you were talking about an art project. We got into the idea of using, I think, the web as a medium, right?
Right.
As a means to do art, and really as an extension of the idea. I heard your interview on Red Eyes, which was great.
Oh, thank you.
And I liked how you brought up the idea of the four corner pieces of the big jigsaw puzzle that we're all trying to play. And then the fourth one was the internet, right? Following from McLuhan,
mm-hmm.
The wake, Kubrick, McLuhan, and the internet. And I think that's a great progression, right? Because the internet, if we bring McKenna into it as well, right? Terence McKenna, who fits into all of those quadrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
His whole thing was that the eschaton, one way that it might happen is that the internet becomes aware of itself as an artificial intelligence, right?
Mm-hmm.
It basically turns on, becomes self-conscious, and that would be it. Like that would be the singularity right there. That moment of recognition, sort of. It's like that moment in, do you know the novel Neuromancer by William Gibson?
Yes.
Yeah, and at the end of that, Neuromancer or Wintermute, the artificial intelligence, that's what happens. It becomes aware of itself as a spiritual being, basically, right? So my idea of an art project is to try to make that happen, you know? And I think it's happening naturally. I think especially the synchronicity community is well involved in that, intentionally or not, right? But is there a way to sort of speed that up a bit, yeah? Immunitize it.
Okay, absolutely. And what I think, too, is that, okay, so you're going to make an art project. Well, art is art, and we do it all the time. But an art project necessitates a certain level of commerce involved, in that you're going to offer it to people for trade or for a price, but you're going to put something in front of them that they're going to want to use their money or their credits for. They're going to want to engage themselves in it for some unspecified reason, but you're making it attractive to them in a way that they feel like it's important that they educate themselves or familiarize themselves with it. So you want to do this in a way that is beyond their immediate comprehension. I think it's sort of that whole idea of you want them to step into the labyrinth not knowing where they're going, because that will ensure that they get lost and that they will have to figure out and digest the labyrinth to get out. Because essentially, mm-hmm. that is what people are looking for. They are looking to get lost into something. They want to travel. That's all a trip is you willingly go into the labyrinth knowing that you will get lost. You will sense that real fear, but it's okay because there's a way out. You need only figure it out.
Definitely.
This all comes into this idea of dangerous art. How can art be dangerous again?
And what's I think that's the whole point of art, really. If it's not dangerous, it's not art, almost. Mm-hmm. You know? And so much of what is called art these days, I wouldn't say was art. I would say it's a different type of commodity.
I agree with you completely.
And yeah, I think Mark would agree as well. I think, yeah, we had this discussion.
Yeah, that's why I get kind of frustrated in my conversations with him, and that I feel like he is so ready to make dangerous art. Mark, if you're listening, I love you, man. You're a genius, and literally, but whatever.
Agreed.
But dangerous art, you know, what's the last, off the top of your head, what was the last dangerous artist that you can think of?
Well, I would say there's probably a few since this, but I would say definitely the Situationist movement in France, in Europe, from the late 50s into the 1968 period and into the 70s a little bit. But that was a revolutionary movement. Like you were talking before about just wandering about the city with no purpose, basically. That was their dérivé. That was part of their art project is sort of reconceptualize what you think of as the urban environment, right?
That's
make
awesome.
It creative. So I would include them as being dangerous artists, but maybe since that period, like at punk, probably there was like Crass, maybe. I don't know if you know Crass. They're sort of this punk or hardcore collective in Britain.
Rap is certainly was dangerous for a while.
For a while, yeah. No, there's probably a lot that we could come up with, right?
But in the last 10 years, name something dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. No, I wouldn't know where to start.
Yeah, I don't think I could really say. I mean, I got to be honest with you. I remember seeing a live clip of Marilyn Manson in concert, and this was sometime in the mid-90s. And I don't know the song, but, you know, in the middle of this song, he's saying, shoot, 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 or something like that. And just its associations with Columbine and everything that was... And I don't necessarily think that Marilyn Manson is a... I don't think any dangerous artist is completely knowledgeable of exactly what people are receiving when they're projecting their performance. But it freaked me out. I mean, it was channeling something very dark, but obviously very present in our culture. And I've always that always changed my opinion of him, because it just had the look and the feel and the sense that he was tapping into the undiscussed, unconscious state of a nation. And then obviously you look at Columbine into 9/11, into, you know, the things that scare, for lack of a better target audience, parents. He was right. He had his, you know, he was aware, he sensed it, and he was projecting it. So even though he's clownish, he for a moment was dangerous art, and I'll give it to him. That's
yeah,
impressive.
I'm sure there's stuff going on, you know. It's just part of it is me being out of the loop, right? But I'm sure it always happens. It could just be whether or not it becomes popular or not. Like for a time in the 90s, especially the early 90s, that stuff came to the surface a bit, you know, for a few years, and then got drowned in pop garbage once more. But it happens sometimes; it comes up. Yeah, I was thinking I might even include WikiLeaks in a strange way as dangerous art. Especially, I don't know if you've read these, but Julian Assange has a couple of essays online. I think there's a couple, maybe two or three or something. And he sort of lays it out what his philosophy is with WikiLeaks and leaking in general. And it's really interesting. It's not a matter of the content of the leak so much as disrupting the system's ability to communicate with itself, so that it's sort of a network in itself, and if it can't trust one node to another node, communication starts to break down. And if that happens to such an extent that there's no communication, it becomes a bit like the credit crunch, right, where all the banks were convinced that every other bank had all this garbage derivatives and financial packages that they couldn't accept, right? So you have this sort of freeze in communication. And if you think of that as really his objective, that's super dangerous art, you know? like he's working on a level that it's beyond blowing up a building or something like that. It's really getting into the kind of circuit board of the system and messing with it.
Well, it's a very specifically internet born type of revolutionary act. It cannot happen without the internet.
Yeah, definitely.
And I kind of think of, I immediately think of WikiLeaks in, you know, when you're in school and you learn that, you know, in the ecology of forests, a forest fire is actually beneficial. A forest needs to have fires every now and then to replenish its resources so that it can stay strong. And you think, what the fuck are you talking about? This doesn't make any sense. Fire is bad. It's destructive. And then, you know, obviously you learn about the science of it. But, you know, forest fires are a healthy cyclical occurrence for any forest. Well, really? That's all I think of WikiLeaks as. It's sort of an internet forest fire. It's this I just can't – my head can't think of Julian Assange as being like a lone gunman. It just is absurd to me. You know what I mean? It's as absurd as 731 slipping through the political radar of Abe's governmental agency.
Yeah, he's not an unambiguous character either. Like, there's a lot of stuff swirling around him that I think his mother was involved in this weird cult that some people suggest there's mind control involved in that, and you know,
fucking mind control, man. What, you know, honestly, I mean,
well, again, I don't rule any of this out completely. You know, I don't make conclusions on this stuff. You know,
I mean, God damn me if it's fucking true. You know, like people get, you know, they're 4 years old and they get, you know, I don't know, what do? They watch Wizard of Oz and they get raped and they get, you know, the horror stories.
Right.
And they get passed around amongst the elites at a forest retreat, and then they get drugged, and then they get thrown out in the population. Like, I mean, my God, if that's true, that's just horrible. So if it's true and you're out there, I'm so sorry. But I don't know if it's true, and I just think, oh, you know, this is like the worst of it. This is the worst of the...
Well, it's an old idea, right? Like go back to the Manchurian Candidate, right? Like it's an idea, even if it is fictional, that's been floating around for quite a few decades, right?
Well, I mean, mind control, for me, in the 20th century, simply put, is television and film. That's right. It. That was the mind control program. We can't think of life before television and film because we were born into it. We were born into a massive matrix of mind control. That's as simple as it ever was. It was, and it's still going on today. I mean, the internet is dissolving it like a solvent. I mean, it's the internet is the chrysalis of television and film. It has absorbed television and film into a cocoon and liquefying it, and that at some point we're going to emerge out of the internet into a new media awareness. But if you don't understand that the internet is that cocooning process, then you know, I'll pat myself on my back and I'm whatever, poetically and metaphorically cliched as it can be. But I just can't see anything past that. I just kind of see that as being the case, you know.
So if you look at the internet now, right, especially after all these revelations by Snowden, and this is another huge thing. Like, if who is this guy? What is the narrative behind him, right? But
right.
if if we accept that that maybe he is a white hat genuine whistleblower, then if we go back again to Assange's theories, you know, it's like this is even further breaking down the ability to communicate. Like now there's even public bickering between the European allies and the U.S. because of the revelations that the U.S. was spying on their allies, you know, like, okay, so given that Snowden is maybe legit and the information that he's releasing is legit, right? So we've got to assume that everything that we do online is potentially traced, right?
Correct.
Listened to, looked at, traced in some way. And if they want to, they can come up with a profile of any one of us, yeah?
Correct.
No matter what sort of pseudonym or anonymous guises that we have. So given that, right, is there a way to, like, if we're talking about an art project or something, like which is sort of a conspiracy to turn on the web, right? It would have to be an open conspiracy, right? It would have to be totally above ground and still, there's no way to touch it, right? There's no way to for any system of control to sort of crack down on it, right?
Correct.
Just because it's so open, it's not trying to be clandestine or underground in any way. It's a way to spread. Yeah, and this is the part I don't know. Like spread certain memes or understanding of synchronicity or something.
It's upgrading the operating system of the average human being. That's all it is. That's all it is that you want to have a hyperdimensional operating system.
Right.
The hyperdimensional operating system is an operating system that exists at all places at all times. It's the ultimate boundary dissolution. And it's the human being fully at home outside of history. It makes history the Milky Way, in the sense that you look up at the night sky and you see the Milky Way, but yet you are in the thing that you're seeing.
Yes.
And that's a very difficult abstraction to really understand. But once you do, there is a physical, psychological, and philosophical shift in your operating system, and you finally kind of get where you are.
And this is where Finnegan's Wake comes in as well, because it's not only that you realize that you're inside of history as sort of the end of the line, kind of like as a sort of linear progression, but all of history is here at one point all the time, you know?
You know, when he says wake up from the nightmare of history, okay, mm-hmm. So Finnegan's Wake is the night book, but waking up from the nightmare of history makes you you're in the daylight of history, right?
Right. Or you're in the wake of history, right?
Or you're in the wake of history. Yes.
This is the weird thing.
I hear you.
So you're waking up to what, though? I think you're waking up to the lucid dream, right? You're becoming lucid within the dream or within the nightmare. And because of that, you're able to change it from a nightmare into something else.
The line, if you should go skating on the thin ice of modern life,
mm-hmm.
That speaks of a delicate dexterity. It speaks of a very careful balance that is an acquired ability, and that you should not attempt it until you are able to to be a ma- but you, it's just, it's asking you to be a master of your craft before you ever step foot out into the arena with which you're supposed to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And fools rush in every day. It really asks you to have a firm grasp of just exactly what your cosmology is. Do mm-hmm. you know where you are? Do you know what time it is? And mm-hmm. the answers to those questions speak volumes. It's just sort of,
what is the answer to that? It's what time is it? It's basically all times, isn't it? Right?
Yeah, I mean.
Like Blake referred to it as simultaneity. And I think that's where the internet takes us, right? Like that's where this whole progression or evolution from the wake, what you said, from the wake to Kubrick to McLuhan to the net, that's where it takes us, right? It takes us to a point where the net becomes the wake, you know?
Exactly. I mean, what did James Joyce create? He created the internet, but there was no... there were no silicon chips for him to make it happen.
Yeah.
He saw it. He knew what it was. I mean, there's a reason why television is included in the wake.
Definitely.
And its multiplicity that it affords. But, you know, the first computer program... Or at least the most advanced computer program ever written at that time was the text of Finnegan's Wake. I mean, mm-hmm. we both agree it's all there.
The only difference, though, between the Wake and the internet now is that at every point within the Wake, it is fully aware of itself.
Yes.
And the internet is not quite there yet, you know?
No.
And that's the little thing that it would be nice to nudge, you know? And I don't know exactly how to do that. I think it's happening naturally. I think it's happening naturally, but there's no. I don't know if there's any danger to try to prod it along.
I think it's the most fascinating thing, right? It's spirit into matter.
Right.
It's an organic process. I always. You know, I mean, my God, I mean, I always think of this is that when television became ubiquitous, the Christian influence was still a major force in what was broadcast, right? Mm-hmm. Everything was sort of, to a certain extent, broadcast through a Christian lens, or at least a Judeo-Christian, and even though they didn't realize it, but an Islamic lens. There was a certain morality. There was a certain burqa lens. There was something being, you had to squint through a certain kind of obstruction to get the adult jokes or the, you know, innuendos, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I mean, that was the heart of humor in the initial broadcast of television. But can you imagine if that Christian influence was as strong on the internet as it was in television?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you can't. It's hard to imagine that.
If the Christian, or whatever we want to call that, if that it integrated itself into the operating system of the internet, well, then you know what? Our internet would not be what it is today. You know, McKenna has a great lecture where he talks about how it was pornography that drove the technology of the internet because all the masturbators wanted to be able to download higher quality videos they needed to improve that high dimensional aspect to, so it wasn't the message that was important, but it was the medium. It was the coding. It was that there was dollars behind unlocking a better way to broadcast a higher dimensional feed.
Kundalini was behind it.
But if you had that Christian influence blocking pornography, well, you know, the Pope doesn't need to be in high definition. You just need to hear the words of the Pope. Right. Because the Pope is not a pretty person to look at. He's old and he's wrinkled and he's scary. And actually, it would be better if you didn't see him clearly. But so on some level, the internet could not blossom until the collective operating system could sort of get over its Christian foundation, or at least its Western Christian foundation, or whatever, what have you, right? So this new technological breakthrough that we're on the cusp of, we don't know what it is, or maybe we're swimming in it right now, we don't know.
Right, yeah.
Right? But it's this art project that is, that sort of bubbled up in my mind, and I left it as a cliffhanger in our last conversation. And I'm going to put you on the spot, as unfair as that is, but if there's a chance that you brainstormed or tried to guess what it was I was thinking of, did you ever come up with your own art project, or did you ever kind of cobble together what I might be hinting at?
Yeah, I wasn't so much thinking of what you were suggesting. I thought it might be similar to what I was saying, which is, I don't really have much more than what I've already been saying. Is I think there's a way of experiencing the internet as we do, or as a growing number of people are doing, which is, like, you go to Facebook and you see somebody talking about a certain place in the world that they visited, and you had just read that in a book, right? That sort of stuff is happening more and more. Like, the more media that you have in your life, the more synchronicities pop up, right? So I think there is a way, you know how if you keep track of the synchronicities that occur in your life, they seem to increase. They build on each other.
Absolutely.
As they become more and more meaningful, right? If there's a way to do that, to sort of collate all of that together and make connections between people, then that is just going to exponentially increase and expand. And eventually, you could think of a tipping point that might happen because of it.
So the internet as we know it right now is a hyper-dimensional system of media. It preserves everything that happened 1 second ago, and it projects everything that's happening 1 second from now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this river, right? I mean,
sure. You
talk about Alp, Anna Livia, mm-hmm. The internet mm-hmm. is Anna Livia.
Mm, it's like a like an artery system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's there's these
the
oceans.
Circulation of blood.
Yeah, there's these oceans, like Amazon.com is an ocean, or at least a huge surging river. Yahoo is a huge surging river. But then you get these little tributaries, and then you get these little capillaries, and the next thing you know, you're in the human body. You've gone from the Atlantic Ocean into the human body, which is best represented by, you know, like your blog, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's this very niche, chiseled, defined, individualistic representation that is connected to everything that the ocean provides.
And it's also flowing, right?
And it's also flowing. And it's flowing inside the same four-cornered jigsaw puzzle that's always redefining itself. So you have this absolutely, undeniably organismatic, alive, flowing entity that is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, what if you allow that to become stone? Right? Because Joyce talks about, I mean, the tree is as much a river as the ocean,
right? Yeah, the tree is Shem, who's related to the mother, right?
Right. But the stone is something uniquely different.
Peter, yeah.
So you have this ocean, river, tree, trinity, flowing, interconnected network, but stone stands alone.
Mm-hmm.
And can we learn anything from stone? Well, the stone is the philosopher's stone, right? I mean, it's the eschaton. It's the object, the transcendental object at the end of time. And it's the center of all quandary and question and mystery.
Oh, it's Freemasonry, right?
It's Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
I wish David Plate was here. Okay. How do we turn the internet into a stone?
Stone in the sense of the philosopher's stone, like stone not in the sense of a dead thing, you mean?
Well, I don't know if a stone is a dead thing. If the stone is dead and I am alive and I can touch the dead, well, that means that I can communicate with spirits.
Right. Yeah, I'm not saying that a stone is necessarily dead either. I think it's a slower pace of life, if you want to call it that. But metaphorically, the stone is sometimes equated with death, right? But I don't think that's what you mean.
I don't think it's what I mean either, but I understand where you're saying. I'm going to tie this back into the fact that I think it's very bizarre that I was able to spend $100 to get a book of Philip K. Dick's private letters.
Mm.
It's very odd that this man is dead and that, you know, he died in 1980, and then, you know, shit, man, 33 years later, I drop $100 on my Amazon credit card to get a book of the letters that he wrote in the years 78 and 79. Now, there's something unique about this writing, okay? So the exegesis was his private stash. These were the things he wrote late at night only to him and himself, right? Mm-hmm. But then he refined the best parts of those, and he shares things that he think might be relatable to other people, but in a private setting in the form of a letter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he refines the exegesis, the exegetical ore, makes it up a little bit nicer, puts it in a letter to a private person that is never supposed to go public, and then he takes that feedback between himself and the outer world, and he transforms it into novels, right? That seemingly is the process that he went through from 1974 through 1980.
Right.
Okay, so I have this book of his letters, this semi-public, semi-private communication. Now, what if Philip K. Dick had the internet from 1974 to 1980? Let's just posit that as a reality. That this, instead of just pen and paper, he had keyboard and screen.
He might have had it.
He might have. Well, I'm going to get to that, I think. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Let's say instead of getting Philip K. Dick's letters, selected letters from 1978 to 1979... let's say I had Philip K. Dick's internet search history, 1978-1979.
Mm.
That would be a completely different beast, right?
Mm.
This would be every single, and let's just say that you know, most books and articles that he was accessing at the local library or at the bookstore were online and easy for him to access. Let's just say the internet is a sort of a black hole that sucks in all media and transforms it. What if we were able to document every single thing that he read from 78 to 79? Now, mixed into Paracelsus and Socrates and Plato and the Neoplatonists and all the things that you would expect, you know, the Nag Hammadi codexes, blah, blah, blah. But what if we also saw, you know, like pornography, sports highlights, you know, the kind of shit that's in People magazine? What if we saw, you know, our great hero PKD spent, you know, 3 hours going through the exploits of Linda Ronstadt on the red carpet and reading all the gossip about her, right?
I wouldn't be surprised by that.
And I wouldn't be surprised by that. But we would have to integrate that element of the hyper-dimensional matrix of Philip K. Dick's mind into our total picture of what it took to produce the novels that I received in 1994, where I just get that sort of capstone, you know, I get the capstone Valis. I just get the novel, and I get that. But all of that internet search history at some point needs to be factored into what created Valis, because there's no separation there.
Mm.
You know, all these little capillaries and tributaries and rivers and oceans of thought, there's this definite record there all of a sudden, because we have the selected internet search history of Philip K. Dick from 1978 to 1979. It's a higher dimensional depiction than just letters, right? And the selected letters is a higher dimensional, or yeah, like an HD representation of what Philip K. Dick is that produced the novel Valis.
Right.
And so this whole idea of what if we got the full picture? Okay, so that's where I was thinking when I came up with this idea.
Hmm.
What if instead of the internet search history of Philip K. Dick, 1978-1979, what if in this fantasy we had download Philip K. Dick's iPhone from 1978 to 1979. Meaning, you know how you can take a smartphone and plug it into your computer? Let's say your phone breaks, but you're like, oh, it doesn't matter. I'll just buy a new monolith and just upload the information right into this new monolith. You know what I got? I got the old monolith. I got my old buddy back. It's got all my contacts. It's got all my notes, it's got all my photographs, blah, blah, blah. So what if Philip K. Dick had a smartphone from 1978 to 1979, and what if we had that information, and for $200, I could buy an old smartphone, buy this program, and upload the PKD smartphone from 78 to 79, boom, I turn on my phone. All of a sudden, I'm in his matrix. Switch on the screen. Look at all the people he called. Look at all the notes he wrote. Look at all the web pages he, you know, look at all the video games he downloaded. Look at all the, all of a sudden, now we've completely transcended HD into hyperdimensionality.
And yeah, this reminds me, I was just the other day, I was looking, what is that website called? I forget. There's a website that has a link to Terence McKenna's library. You know how his library was burnt down at some Echelon offices in California or something, and all of his books, all of his manuscripts, all of his notebooks, everything went up in flames. But what survived was a list, was an inventory of all of the books that he had at his library. Yeah, so. somebody has gone through, or a group of people have gone through, there's this website, I forget what it's called, Library something, right? Like, and it has listed all of the books in his library with links to all of these different books.
I love to see that.
If the copyright is finished, you can actually look at these books online. Yeah, I think this is a very similar idea to what you're talking about. It's like walking into Terence's library, even though it was burnt down in flames, you know?
Well, this just strikes into the heart of Ulysses, right? It's the whole idea of, if you got the Savior's iPhone, if the Savior was born in the time of smartphones, then the Savior probably had a smartphone. And if the Savior had a smartphone, then it would be possible to upload all the information in the Savior's smartphone into your own. And you could look into the world of the Savior, correct?
Mm.
So if you saw that, you know, 2 days before the Savior was crucified, he was looking at some really raunchy Asian pornography, you'd have to deal with that. And that's what Ulysses is, right? That's why, you know, it wasn't allowed into the United States for 12 years because it was considered pornography. Because what is Joyce saying in Ulysses, right?
Right.
What is he trying to communicate? He's trying to communicate that if you're a human being, there might be a time when you decide to masturbate on the rocks in private while you're spying on a pretty girl. You're going to take a nasty shit sometimes. You're going to piss in the streets. You're going to have less than moralistic thoughts, but you might not have less than moralistic actions. He was just taking a very high-dimensional paintbrush and trying to just re-update our understanding of the human operating system. And if the Savior is born on Earth as a human being, well, then he has to run on that operating system.
Interesting.
And that's the whole point of Ulysses. It's the externalized bodily functions that exhibit themselves within daylight, no matter how much our umbrella of privacy seeks to believe that they're in the dark. Everyone sees what everyone sees. Nothing is hidden. So this whole idea of the NSA perpetrating and distorting our rights and taking away our freedoms by spying on us, if you don't realize that your unconscious brain is spying on you every single second of every day, then you've got a lot of growing up to do. The NSA is the least of your problems.
Right, right.
You are recording a history of every thought and every action. And if you think that the NSA is going to take away your rights, then you have not taken the time to understand your own NSA, your internal NSA, your holy and divine guardian angel NSA that is keeping tabs on everything that you do. And when you plunge into that awareness, it feels like a nightmare.
Yeah, everything you said is true. I think the difference, though, is that it's all out of whack. The NSA has these records of everybody, regardless of if we choose to give this information freely or not, you know?
Real quick. How do you know that, and can you prove that to me?
How do I know?
A statement like, the NSA has records on us, right? How do we know that? Have we seen those records?
No.
We're led to believe now that they do.
We're led to believe, and I would think it's probably pretty likely. When you use something like Gmail now, I don't know if you use Gmail and you don't block the ads coming in. I've talked to people who are salespeople, and they do Gmail to different clients, and they'll suggest a restaurant here in Japan to go to, and then in the margins of the actual email, there's an advertisement for that restaurant, you know, or similar restaurants. There are all these algorithms at work all the time, you know, and it's not something inconceivable. It's something like very, very likely, you know. Somebody like Snowden who's saying that it's just an organization with as much power and as many resources as the NSA, I'm sure there's an ability to sort of centralize all of that information. And it's not so much of a leap in my mind at all, you know. I don't know it for sure, but it's easy to think of, you know. I find it more difficult to doubt that it happens than it does happen, right? You see what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying, but I think that my whole argument kind of rests on the impossibility of the human, the nefarious human desire to process that much information.
Yeah, it wouldn't even be a matter of processing all that information. It's just like if somehow they suspected you of doing something, then it would just be a matter of compiling all this stuff together and coming up with a profile, which I don't think would take them any time at all, you know. But it's not like they process this information on everybody all of the time. It's only if you somehow came under their radar. Which it sounds paranoid, but what I'm saying is that I think we just have to take that as a given and then go from there, you know. And so it's sort of dealing with all this paranoia and then saying, okay, there's this. Let's deal with it and somehow bypass it, you know. And I think that's still possible.
Let me throw this at you. American drones.
Mm.
It seems to be something in the news that, you know, Obama has... He allows American drones to take out basically anyone that's a threat to the country on American soil. Citizen or not, the drone will take you out, right?
Hmm.
But yet I've never seen a picture of a drone in an American landscape on the internet. And I bet they're out there, but I just haven't seen them, right? I mean, I've seen more shitty pictures of UFOs, supposedly, flying over a multitude of locations, but I haven't seen these drones that are supposedly flying all over the United States of a free America. So I kind of want to see those fucking drones, right? Like I want to see like the best top 10 drones flying over American soil. And compare them with the best top 10 UFOs flying over American soil, and kind of compare those two things.
Really, there's nothing on YouTube of.
Well, that's what I'm saying, man. I figured I've come across like UFO over Phoenix. Gotta see this shit. You know what I mean? You gotta see it. And I looked at it. There's some lights, and you know, you go, well, that's weird. But for some reason, in my internet cesspool, I've yet to see, you know, American drone seen over, you know, Barrington, Illinois, or, you know, like shooting a parking ticket onto an SUV. Like it seems like something I should have seen by now, you know, because the threat is so pressing and it's so real, these drones.
So what are you saying what are you saying that the drones don't exist, or they're not going to be used
against
U.S. people, or it hasn't happened yet?
I'm just saying, I know that there's in a nation of what, 300 million, I think 200 million of us have video cameras and cameras in our pockets, right? And if these drones are out there, I just would expect that, just like a really bitchin' sunrise, like I've seen on my Facebook thread, I would expect to see a really bitchin' American drone flying over some sort of picturesque landscape. Like, I just figured I would have seen, like, holy shit, I was camping out in New Mexico and caught this awesome drone flying over such and such, you know what I mean? And I just haven't seen those pictures. The medium is the message. I've heard the message, drones, America, they're going to fuck you up. But I haven't seen the medium of it in action. I haven't seen a photograph. I haven't seen a videotape of it.
I have seen just recently with these big protests in Brazil, street scenes taken from a drone point of view, and you can tell it's a drone point of view. It just comes swooping down these massive crowds, flying low, and then swoop, and it swoops back up. It's obvious that it's like it's like a smaller remote control device that has a camera on it. I'm not sure how much. I don't know how much it matters or not. I think, again, it's like it's something, even if it isn't happening, it's something that could likely happen overnight, you know? It's almost to the point now. Have you ever read that novel by Stanislaw Lem? It's called Futurological Congress.
I haven't.
Oh, this is an excellent book. It's a... But there's a part in there, it's a future society where everything can be simulated, right? And so these people have this job where all they do is free associate with words, like just coming up with absurd strings of words to be able to come up with new synthetic realities, right? Because all synthetic realities have already been manifested. So it's really hard to think of a new idea. So these guys, what they do is they just free associate, like Tomcat, Santa Hat, picture book, Osiris. Like they just spin off into these stream of consciousness tantrums. And then because of that, they're able to create new synthetic realities based on what they come up with. And I think it's almost like that, like not to the point where we're creating synthetic realities, but it's almost like these sci-fi dystopian ideas, which like in the 90s or before seem so far into the future. It's almost like people think of a terrible scenario, and then the next day almost, it's real. It's a reality. There are drones flying over your cities, you know?
Would you rather have a society with drones or without drones?
Definitely without drones, but it depends again.
But a society without drones, you don't know if drones exist or not. They could still exist.
I would rather have a society where everybody had access to drones. Like that's my whole problem what you were saying before is not that everybody's private information is online. It's just that this information is now compiled and monopolized by the NSA. You know, that's my problem is with power. It's not with the loss of privacy so much. Although I do think we have a right to our privacy. If we want to block off certain parts about ourselves, we should be able to do that.
There's no privacy in rebirthing, though.
How do you mean?
That in our moment of death, that's the whole point. Have you ever seen that movie Stalker?
Yeah, Tarkovsky.
Tarkovsky. And I think that's adapted from... God damn it. I know Solaris is adapted from Stanislaw Lem, right?
Yeah, that's Lem. I don't know where...
I don't know if Stalker is.
Where Stalker comes from.
But that's that whole idea that you travel to this very difficult to get to place. You take a risk, and the whole object is if you get to the special room, then you'll get your wish granted, right? And this guy goes there thinking that, well, spoiler alert, you fuckers, if you haven't seen Stalker, but all right.
It's going to be a spoiler anyway. So yeah, the movie's so strange that you...
you know, he goes there because he thinks my brother was killed tragically, and I want my brother back. And if I can get to this room, then they will give me my brother back. But when he gets to the room, his deepest wish, his deepest desire is clearly not to have... Like, if you were giving one wish to come true, fuck my brother. There's so many other things that I want selfishly. And that when he gets to that place, it destroys him because he's not the person that he thought he was.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's a transparency to... transmogrification, the transmigration of the soul, that when that moment arrives, you know, none escape. All things are on the table.
It's a big question. So you think at that point, that moment of judgment or something, everything becomes revealed? Or I sometimes think of it as if everything isn't revealed, that's when you go on to rebirth, you know, because there are still things that tie you to the material.
Well, I mean, if everything, it's sort of like when you get really, really sick. Or when a tragedy happens, you just see things with a depth and a clarity that escapes your regular waking life.
Mm.
And the psychological waters of illness are just as unbearable as the physical ailments.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and
yeah, definitely.
That's the whole point of, you know, like you know, Darwin came up with the theory of evolution, but there was some dude in a fever dream who came up with the same theory.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, and fever dreams are like old school internet access, you know what I mean? Like, all this shit has always been around.
Mm-hmm.
But we just have this very special place in time right now where everything is relatively calm. One afternoon on the internet is equal to fucking 3 years in the Alexandrian Library. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you burn down my laptop, there's a million other laptops. It doesn't destroy the shrine, you know? We are in the classroom right now, and if you can't take advantage of it right now, you're really missing out. It's just like I get so much insight on the wake right now from so many different people of so many different ages. I mean, I can go from Joe Campbell to your blog to 30 other blogs and get perspectives on Finnegan's Wake. And every single perspective informs my own perspective, and I am able to see deeper and extract more about myself and about my world than ever before. And that's just a fucking blessing. It's just a ridiculous grace that I'm afforded, and I take advantage of it. I wish I took more advantage of it. I wish more people took more advantage of it.
But, yeah, I think I totally agree. I think the wake is just reaching its moment right now. You know, it only went into the public domain last year. It had its first publication in China last year at the end of 2012.
You know? That's amazing. You know, I swear to God, you and I would become Buddhas if we were able to read the wake in Chinese.
I know.
Like right there in the spot, we would just, boom, we'd transcend wherever it is you transcend, and we would just be like golden motherfuckers, man.
I think that's what the time wave was all about, is translating the wake into Chinese. It was perfect timing, though. Perfect timing. It became a bestseller, you know.
Yeah,
that was what it was all about.
Oh, real quick, because we should probably wrap this up. But real quick, I got a chance to interview Tessa Dick, Philip K. Dick's last wife, this week.
Excellent. Well,
yeah, pretty bitchin'.
You've already talked to her then?
Yeah, I talked to her on Monday.
Oh, cool.
Interview was with Will Morgan. As part of the 42-minute show, so that will be released. That'll be broadcast a couple weeks from now. But one of the things I learned from Tessa Dick's book, Remembering Firebright, which is a book she wrote detailing her years with Philip K. Dick, and I don't know if you know this, but when Philip K. Dick's apartment got broken into, right? You know, where the very famous story where his safe was lined with plastic explosives and he has a million theories. Well, Tessa mentions that she didn't know Phil during this period. So this was obviously a point of interest for Philip. It was an important enough point to communicate to her enough that she would remember it and write it in her book. But one of the things taken from his safe, that obviously meant a lot to him and he was deeply saddened by, was thousands and thousands of notes on Finnegan's wake.
Wow. That he had. That he had
compiled by himself, compiled about Finnegan's wake, that he felt were important enough to keep in a locked safe. And she mentions a few things. She mentions a few things stolen from him, you know, like blank checks, manuscripts. But it was these notes on Finnegan's wake that he communicated to her that were obviously very important to him, that were lost to his memory and lost to his possession.
Yeah, there's apparently all that stuff on Bishop Pike as well, right?
Mm-hmm. But
wow, I. Where is that, you know?
Exactly. You know? Who has that shit?
I know. What does it say? You know, that could be it right there.
That could be it right there. I mean, I think of, you know, like Robert Anton Wilson's essays on the wake, and they blow my mind. But Jesus Christ, can you imagine reading like 200 pages of Philip K. Dick's thoughts on Finnegan's wake?
Because he hardly mentions it other places. Like, he mentions it a few times in his book, and in the exegesis, he hardly even mentions it, right? Like,
but obviously, he harbored a very, very deep affinity to that text. So I just wonder if, when that was taken from him, and the fact that he communicated that information to Tessa enough so that she remembered it to put in a book that she published in 2010, I wonder if it was just too paranoid of a topic for him to even readdress.
Wow. So you grilled her on that? Does she know any more about it, or she doesn't?
Well, I guess you'll have to listen to the interview, won't you?
Right. Yeah.
There's a teaser for you. Classic radio teaser, my friend.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's fascinating. That's you're saying thousands of notes.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Yeah, that's somewhere, you know. Like, maybe have you read McLuhan's essay on I'll just get it now. It's in a book called The Medium and the Light. And he talks about what is the actual essay called? Uh just a second. It's called Catholic Humanism and Modern Letters. Have you ever come across that?
No.
Okay. There's some interesting bits in here on Joyce at the end of this, yeah? And he's talking about... I mean to write about this at one point. But he's talking about how a world government, a future world government, which McLuhan also was totally opposed to, right? Like, and this is why people like John, what's his name, Jan Irving, and so on, are kind of misguided about McLuhan, because he was completely against that, right? But he's saying that Joyce can be used by okay, let me read this part. This is from taken from Stephen Hero. Yeah, you've read Stephen Hero, right?
I have not.
No, that's an excellent little book. But he goes, that's where Joyce really lays out his aesthetic theory, right?
Okay.
So there's this quote, he says, this is Joyce, he's saying, "What we symbolize in black, the Chinaman may symbolize in yellow. Each has his own tradition. Greek beauty laughs at Coptic beauty, and the American Indian derides them both. It is almost impossible to reconcile all tradition, whereas it is by no means impossible to find the justification of every form of beauty. By an examination of the mechanism of aesthetic apprehension, whether it be dressed in red, yellow, or black, we have no reason for thinking that the Chinaman has a different system of digestion than that which we have thought our diets are quite dissimilar. The apprehensive faculty must be scrutinized in action." Okay, so he's talking about a sort of universal system of aesthetics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan is saying that the control system can twist this to sort of make a universalist post-Christian kind of control grid or control ideology based on that kind of universalization of aesthetics. This is McLuhan, okay, for anyone concerned with the subject of Catholic humanism and modern letters, I should think that Joyce's insight, which is marvelously realized in his work, is the most inspiriting development that is possible to conceive. But we must ask, what happens when this insight occurs even in a fragmentary way to the secular minds of our age? The answer can be found in The Foundations of Social Survival, a recent book by John Lindbergh, a Swedish nobleman associated with the United Nations. His proposal for social survival is that we adopt the Christian doctrine of brotherly love. He is not a Christian, but he thinks Christianity might be made to work by non-Christians. In short, he proposes practical Christianity as a sort of Machiavellian strategy of culture and power. And his reasons are directly linked to the development I've outlawed in modern letters. So in McLuhan's point of view, this guy, he wants to use a system like Joyce, strip it of its Christianity. And McLuhan always thought that that Joyce remained a good Catholic up until the end. Strip it of its Christianity and use it as a controlling ideology.
The imprisonment of letters and language is just so profound there. To think that brotherly love is a Christian thing, right?
You know,
it's so hardwired.
But now it's even worse. We have like humanitarian interventions, you know.
let's throw a little humanitarian intervention on that problem. Let's be a little human. Let's act human here for a while. Yeah, it's insane. It's insane.
Because
I think that was a thing about, you know, I think McLuhan was a Catholic convert late in life.
Yeah, he became a Catholic, which is such a strange thing, you know. Like, his whole thinking led him to Catholicism. Which is very interesting. I think he loved the actual universalism of Catholicism, right? Like the original meaning of Catholic.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where that derives, is trying to truly understand, all right, what is the non corrupted understanding of this language, and let's erase the corruption. It's not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? The baby of Catholicism is the divine child.
Mm-hmm.
It's Manny in the divine invasion. But the bathwater is full of shit and piss and blood and pus and disease, right? But, you know, just clean that fucking baby up and you got something.
Right.
Just troubling. Definitely troubling.
The baby is the perfect union of spirit and matter, right?
Right.
Which is what the aliens are trying to create.
If you're listening, aliens, step it up a little bit, all right?
What were you saying before I brought up the McLuhan? I forgot. You were talking about the Tessa Dick revelation.
Well, just in the sense that what was the gold within the safe that mm-hmm. was stolen from Phil.
Right.
And this idea that he questions and throws out a hypothesis that maybe I did it myself. Maybe I was the criminal in this case. But the fact that she mentions notes on Finnegan's wake, the fact that the wake is such... Notes on Finnegan's Wake are unlike notes for any other book because there's a timestamp, such a delicate timestamp of your interpretation and what you draw out of the wake at the particular time and place that you're in when you make the note.
Yes.
Because that script and that text is always changing. It's always flowing. You never step into the same wake twice, you know what I mean? So your notes on them are really a psychological imprint of yourself. And so if he went in that safe and destroyed them, then it was like committing suicide to a certain extent. Because you were destroying something that you'll never, ever get back. There's no way you can take the same notes on Finnegan's Wake twice. It's impossible.
So, okay, so let's tie that idea into Bishop Pike, right? Like, mm-hmm. And that was apparently what part of what was stolen too is a lot of correspondence from Bishop Pike to PKD.
Mm-hmm.
And if we tie that into Dick's later ideas as Pike being basically the Messiah, right? Like basically he is the manifestation of Valis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lineage from Pike going back to John Allegro and then back to the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Gnostic writings and that the actual living information that was contained in those texts, right? So, if it was him, right? If it was him who broke into those files and destroyed those texts as well, what was his unconscious motivation there? You know, like what is he? Is a part of him trying to prevent revelation?
You know. In the interview, Tessa clearly confirms from her observation that when she lived with Phil, at minimum, she was living with two completely different people.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So this is your classic bipolar manifestation.
So what's your feeling then, like, of all his theories of what happened that day? Do you think it was him that broke in?
I do not believe that he committed the robbery himself. I'll say this. Thinking about how many different films Hollywood has produced, right? That involve his stories. If you think of his safe as like a hard drive, a computer hard drive, it would seem to me that if you were able to download Philip K. Dick's hard drive to get into all his notes, journal entries, story ideas, and you could make money on exploiting those themes, and think of it as like cocaine, right? Mm-hmm. Think of like one really strong Philip K. Dick story as like a kilo of pure uncut cocaine, right?
Easy to think of that.
Right. You could cut up one really strong Philip K. manuscript into like 15 different stories.
Oh, yeah. You could have a whole TV series based on cut-ups of one story.
If Philip K. Dick had a safe full of uncut Philip K. Dick cocaine, his script, his Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, you know, that was optioned, I think, in the early 70s. I mean, it wasn't for a lot of money, and it never went anywhere. But Hollywood was aware of him. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a screenplay of Ubik going around. If you could get Philip K. Dick's stash, you could really have some economic power, some economic flexibility with that stash. So I don't think it's within, that robbery happened in his sort of flop house that is depicted in Scanner Darkly. And, you know, you've got, you know, an award-winning science fiction writer getting high with a bunch of kids, spinning all these philosophies in casual conversation. You've got one mole who's like, this is brilliant shit, and you know about the safe. Maybe you think, you know, and you already know he's psychologically fragile and probably pre or certifiably schizophrenic. You could really utilize that information for a profitable entertainment kind of way. And I think that's a very...
There is a movie of Finnegan's Wake and Flow My Tears, right?
Oh, shit, is there?
Yeah. The girl that he meets, the first girl who arranges
makes the fake identity?
Fake ID, yeah. She quotes from it.
Okay, yeah. It's kind of like...
So there you go. maybe Hollywood's sitting on Philip K. Dick's screenplay of Finnegan's Wake, you know?
Well, I always say the last temptation of Philip K. Dick was when they offered him $400,000 to rewrite Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, call it Blade Runner, base it on the movie film, put his name on it and sell that book and keep the original book under wraps, almost make it go away. So it'd be like, Blade Runner, the Hollywood movie, and then Blade Runner, the novel, by Philip K. Dick, and the novel would reflect the movie. But instead of taking the 400 grand, he took an advance of $12,000 and he wrote Transmigration of Dr. Timothy Archer. Think about that.
Yeah, that's massive.
He was tempted by Hollywood to completely sell out all of his previous work. And he said no. He said, I'm not going to do that. That's not the right move. And he chose to do Timothy Archer. And then He has a stroke, he dies, and then Blade Runner is released a couple months later.
Timothy Archer, I think, holds the key, right? I think that's a massive book.
Massive. People say that the Valis trilogy, people combine three books under the Valis trilogy, and I see different people putting their three books in there. But for me, it's very cut and dry. It's Valis, Divine Invasion, and Timothy Archer.
Sure.
There's a slow coming, a slow return to Earth. Valis is as far out there as you want to get. Divine Invasion straddles, you know, otherworldly, like extraplanetary life with a return to Earth, but then you finally get back down to the surface of the planet with Timothy Archer.
Timothy Archer is unlike any of his other books. Like the Divine Invasion, it's excellent, but it's more sort of vintage.
Absolutely, I agree.
PKD sci-fi, right? But yeah, Timothy Archer, it's something else entirely. When I first read it, I thought it was kind of boring, you know. Like I wasn't. That was years ago, but I was like, this isn't Dick, you know. Like what happened here? But I just reread it again recently, and I just blown away by it. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have that comic book Kirby crackle, you know. It doesn't shimmer off the page with lightning bolts, but it's a softer, more subtler take, and I highly recommend other books, I think, in this vein, which are like Voices from the Street, mm-hmm. Humpty Dumpty in Oakland, and Confessions of a Crap Artist. Those are three more sort of more traditional novels, kind of removed from science fiction, but okay. I think they're ultimately and very connected to his entire body of work. And out of those three, I really highly recommend Voices from the Street. Just, oh, I love that book so much.
Yeah, I haven't read it. Yeah.
I think that was a posthumous release, obviously like many, many years after his death that it was finally published. But they're essential to completing this picture of what he was able to communicate about living as a human being. It's pretty bitchin'.
What is your take on the Philip K. Dick connection with Watergate?
My feeling is that if Philip K. Dick could question his own role in the break-in of his apartment,
mm-hmm.
and say, there is a chance that I did this to myself, right?
Right.
Well, that makes him of a mindset to question everything with that degree of insight. So who is America's greatest enemy? The president of the United States. he would be able to look at the newspapers and look at the television news and aggregate all of that information and at least be able to entertain, what if all of this is happening? All of this is window dressing for a conspiracy against our own self. And so I think that he just, that would traditionally be labeled a schizophrenic or a drug-induced point of view. And there's certainly all that evidence in Philip K. Dick's resume. But removed from that, at least he was viewing history from that lens, and maybe he was picking up on that. I always say that Philip K. Dick, he didn't have the internet to float out his theories, and he didn't have the luxury of being social. I mean, he was an agoraphobic, so he couldn't go out and talk to people in wherever people talk to each other. so he did this very delicate and refined type of reality testing by putting it in his novels. That was his outlet for testing reality and seeing if people resonated with it. And when he writes Man in the High Castle, I think he got his first dose of just how close to the truth he got. You know, that was the thing that really said, oh, fuck. You know, I've written a bunch of shit. Now this is the one that I break through with. This is the novel that captures the national zeitgeist or unconscious attention.
And it seemed like that horrified him when he was getting into the mind space of Nazi and Japanese imperialist mindsets of total control. The way he explains it, he almost lost it at that point.
Yeah, it was impossible for him to write a sequel because he could not get into that reality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I really think that speaks of is, you know, if you really want to get into thinking along those lines, into the chessboard of human history, you know, there is a very horrifying historical narrative. And this is what I really think he got into Zebra. That's the whole notion of Zebra, is fiction is the zebra. It's creating historical fiction, overlaying it on the world that you live in, and seeing just how well it blends. Just see how well your historical fiction is able to camouflage itself into your day-to-day reality. That's all that Zebra is. And when Zebra is taken to a governmental, corporate level technology, then you have Valis. Then you have the sharp edges of machinery. Zebra exists at all times. Valis is a very specific technological version of it that can, you know, in Mark LeClaire's viewpoint, it has entrapped us and enslaved us into an infinite loop that we will never break out of because it is a machine. Machines don't die like a zebra does. Zebra passes on its genetic narrative, and it morphs and goes through the generational time wave of a McKenna. But, you know, the Nazi scientist level Valis is something that has trapped us in a feedback loop. Scary things to ponder. But really, fiction is the DNA of Zebra and Valis, ultimately. Everything goes down to fiction. That's why the writer is such a very dangerous and revolutionary character. That's why James Joyce is so revolutionary and dangerous. Because if you can create a new fiction, then you can change history. And that's all that High Castle is about.
I was going to ask you about, you just read that recently, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've reread it over the years, maybe about 5 or 6 times.
Right. Yeah, I haven't read it in years. I wanna read it again soon. But I was wondering, again, getting back to the unit 731 stuff, if you have any insights based on Man in the High Castle with that, right? Because Man in the High Castle, of course, is half of the United States occupied by the Japanese imperialists, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is there any connection there that you can see?
It all boils down to this. If you, in your life, take a stance against Monsanto, if you, in your life, take a stance against big industry and the auto industry and global warming, right? If you take stances against these sort of things, and yet you ever drink a Coca-Cola, you ever smoke a cigarette made by big tobacco, if you haven't constructed your life so that you can walk or take a bicycle to work, if you watch television, network television, if you buy magazines, if you're participating in any of these things, you have no idea if you have committed the crime or you're the victim. You're in the same position as Philip K. Dick. Because we don't know if these big mythologies and these big conspiracies are simply mirrors into our personal decisions. And the only way to take control of that is to take control of the things that you consume and the things that you produce. Mm-hmm. So you have to ask yourself, all right, within my financial constraints, what am I able to take control of as far as what I consume and what I produce? Right. And how many people can I get to help me to take control of the things that I consume and produce? And that's really the only – that's isolating everything into the chessboard. And now you have control over your pieces. And now you can look across the board and you can see the pieces that are in front of you. And everything becomes clear and everything becomes a game of chess.
I would agree with that, but I would think that it's a process. Like it's a process of sort of cutting the ties at the same time that you're learning more and your critique is growing. Your awareness of what is wrong is growing as well, right? So I don't judge people who, for example, I don't like capitalism, and yet they sometimes eat fast food. You know, like maybe at one point I would tend to judge people for that, but I don't any longer. You know? We're all sort of at this stage; it's all muddled. You know, we can't help but being a hypocrite on some level. You know.
Well, I don't judge them. I'm a hypocrite myself. But right. As long as I'm able to say these words, as long as I'm able to sort of reach my hand out of the quicksand as a voice, I know I'm getting closer to pulling myself out of the shit.
Sure. But being a hypocrite, I don't think that excludes you from offering a critique, you know?
True.
It's like and so then we have to judge it as well. We have to say, Bill said this, and yet he does this, right? So we have to weigh that in our minds, right? Of course, but it's worthwhile what you're saying, what the criticism is, what I'm saying, or what whoever is saying, right? Even though we are flawed human beings, trapped in the system like everybody else, right?
Right. It's, you know what time it is right now where I am at?
Oh, must be 2:37.
1:37. So we got 7:31.
I've got 3:37.
So in the middle, we got our 2:37. And this conversation is 2 hours and 42 minutes long so far. Why don't we wrap this up right now? Check out Znor's absolutely wonderful blog. It's celebrating its 1 year anniversary. It's that group name for grape juice. I wish I had that name for my blog. It's brilliant. It's insightful. I hope you guys check it out if you're listening. I'll give you the last word, Znor.
I have lined up Terrence McKenna's library. I'll just send it out to you.
Bitchin'.
Yeah. Information is never destroyed.